From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Anjali Kadambi.
This week on War News Radio, Critical Perspectives. We learn about the recent violence in Iraq.
Then, we look into art and conflict.
Finally, we hear about the last missing American soldier in Iraq.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai has tried to delay the formation of a new parliament for another month. A special court appointed by Karzai has asked for more time to look into allegations of fraud in last September's parliamentary elections. The parliament is now scheduled to open on February 22nd. A majority of Afghanistan's members of parliament have refused to postpone the session. The September elections have shown clear evidence of fraud, and over a million votes, almost a quarter of the total, have already been discarded.
President Karzai arrived in Moscow to meet with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. Karzai's National Security Advisor, Ranjin Sponta, said that the purpose of the trip is to discuss Russian support for Afghan security forces. Sponta emphasized that Afghanistan is looking to ensure its security after 2014, when American and coalition forces planned to leave the country.
A roadside bomb killed 20 Afghan civilians in Paktika province, south of Kabul. The civilians were traveling to receive medical treatment when their vehicle triggered a bomb. A number of women and children were killed in the blast. Roadside bombs continue to be the leading source of civilian deaths in Afghanistan, where 2,400 civilians were killed last year.
The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime released its annual report expressing concern at the likelihood of increased opium production in Afghanistan. Last year, after an unknown disease destroyed a large amount of opium crops, prices more than doubled. The price jump created additional incentive for farmers to grow opium instead of other crops. In recent years, counter-narcotics programs reduced the number of Afghan provinces where opium is produced. But the resurgence of the Taliban in northern Afghanistan threatens to renew opium cultivation in areas where the crop has been eliminated.
A recent study from the American Journal of Psychiatry found that implementing mental health screenings for soldiers before deployment reduced the likelihood of psychiatric problems. The study examined 6 brigades of soldiers being deployed to the same area in Iraq. Before deployment, 3 brigades were screened while the other 3 were not. The study found that over a 6-month period, screened brigades experienced a 50% lower rate of suicidal thoughts and behaviors, as well as a 78% lower rate of psychiatric or behavioral problems. The study comes at a time when the U.S. Army is experiencing an increase in suicide rates among its soldiers.
The Obama administration is expected to lift a ban started in 2009 on initiating new charges against Guantanamo Bay detainees. Military tribunals could begin hearing cases within weeks. One of the first cases will likely be against Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, arrested in connection with the bombing of the destroyer USS Cole that killed 17 Americans. New draft regulations for the trials are in the works. A military commission has also been tasked with deciding when the war with al-Qaeda officially began, which may impact the legal status of some detainees.
Gullit Mohammed, a 19-year-old American, has been detained in Kuwait for weeks. Mr. Mohammed claimed that he was tortured and interrogated in a Kuwaiti jail before he was transferred to a deportation center. He was questioned about whether he had made contact with militants while traveling in Yemen and Somalia. Mr. Mohammed has denied any ties to militants, and his lawyers have sued the U.S. government over his treatment.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair was called before the Chilcot Inquiry, a panel reviewing the United Kingdom's role in the invasion of Iraq. The investigation started in July 2009, and new documents have surfaced questioning whether Blair acted legitimately in the days leading up to the invasion. The panel also has access to personal notes sent from Blair to former U.S. President George W. Bush, but were not allowed to release them to the public.
2 American soldiers were killed and another wounded during training exercises at a U.S. base near Mosul in Iraq. Reports vary, but 1 or 2 Iraqi soldiers smuggled live ammunition for their AK-47s into drills aimed at preparing Iraqi troops for building raids and searches. They then turned their guns on the Americans. One of the Iraqi soldiers was killed immediately by U.S. troops.
A suicide bomber killed at least 45 people and wounded 140 more at a police recruiting center in Tikrit, the hometown of Saddam Hussein, just north of Baghdad. No group has claimed responsibility for the bombing, but it resembles attacks by Al-Qaeda affiliate Islamic State of Iraq. Recruiting centers are frequent insurgent targets because of their symbolic importance. The areas just outside of barriers surrounding police stations, where unemployed Iraqis congregate to look for work, are often poorly guarded. Over 60 people were killed at an army recruitment center in August.
A suicide bomber driving an ambulance killed at least 15 people and wounded 52 others at an Iraqi police training facility in Bakuba, just north of Baghdad. The attack was the second such attack on Iraqi security forces in 2 days. The blast caused the collapse of a 3-story building that housed several police and security offices.
2 car bombings outside the Iraqi city of Karbala killed over 50 people and injured almost 200 more. The bombing targeted pilgrims entering Karbala, located in southern Iraq. The city is expected to attract millions of people over the upcoming days before the Shiite holiday of Arbaeen. Later in the show, Aaron Moser will have more on the recent wave of attacks in Iraq.
News from Iraq may not make the headlines so often since the official conclusion of U.S. combat operations last summer, but the nation was afflicted with a brutal new spate of bloodshed this week. War News Radio's Aaron Moser talked with an expert in Baghdad about who might be responsible.
Iraqis were burying the victims of insurgent violence for the 3rd consecutive day Thursday after twin suicide car bombers attacked religious pilgrims gathered in Karbala for the Shiite Muslim mourning day of Arbaeen. A new and sudden surge of violence washed across Iraq this week, with mass casualty attacks in Tikrit, Bakuba, and the holy city of Karbala. War News Radio checked in with New York Times Baghdad correspondent John Leland and learned that the forces behind each incident aren't always as simple as the headlines suggest.
Well, it's hard to draw too many conclusions on the basis of just a couple of days. The attacks of today were on Shiite pilgrims marching toward Karbala, which they do every year and have done for the last 7 years since the fall of Saddam Hussein, because Saddam had banned the marches. And every year they march, and every year they're attacked. So the fact that there are these attacks on them today and to an extent yesterday as well, it is to some extent to be expected.
Although some violence can be understood as part of a cyclical sectarian conflict, Leland thinks that other types of new violence are more concerning.
The attack of earlier in the week, the simple attacks earlier in the week on security forces are present maybe a different kind of trouble, because if the insurgency or whoever is doing this is able to mount sustained attacks on security forces, that poses huge problems with the country and does bring back echoes of the bad old days of 2005, 2006, 2007. The other attack on security forces, that's been a pretty concerted effort that manifests itself in different ways. The last maybe month and a half, we've had pretty regular reports of assassinations using silencer in Baghdad for a lot of December. And now in the last couple of days, we had a horrific attack on outside a job outside of a police station, which about 50 or 60 people were killed. The numbers keep changing a little bit, but it's somewhere in that area. And we had another suicide bombing against the police headquarters in Bakuba tonight. So if people are able to sustain that at a high level, that causes great problems for the Iraqi people, because how can you have a security force if your security force is unable to protect itself?
Leland worries that more sophisticated, organized attacks on Iraqi security forces could become problematic. Leland is also distressed at the accelerating persecution of the Iraqi Christian minority. In late October, an attack on a church in Baghdad killed nearly 60 people. Since then, thousands of Iraqi Christians have fled the country, and this week brought several violent raids of Christian-owned businesses.
Violence against anybody is important, and the Christian life doesn't have a greater value than the Muslim life. Of course, most of the victims of violence here have been Muslim. One thing that is troubling about the attacks on Christians is that they are a minority, and that there is a community to eliminate them. And that's, I would say, different from the Sunni attacks against fellow Sunni clan members or against Shiites. This is really an attempt to drive people out of a region or off the face of the earth.
Is the assault on Christians and the heightened levels of violence in general linked to the return of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr? Leland does not think so.
I haven't seen any reason to believe that. The attacks are most likely coming from Sunni extremists. Muqtada al-Sadr is supposed to be a Shiite. I haven't seen any evidence that he has been a target of these attacks or involved in any way.
Leland does not worry that this string of violence could hinder the growth and development of the fledgling Iraqi government.
As troubling as they are, as horrific as they are, as painful they are, and to the people involved in them, aren't new to Iraqis, aren't new to people in the political system, and there is a desire to move forward.
Violence against Iraq's security forces and Christian population are particularly worrisome. But Leland explains that this week's violence does not necessarily mean anything for the future.
I would like to emphasize that the 3 days don't make a trend. That we might see another lull for a month, and people will say everything's fine, and the right is fine until the 31st day or anything.
Leland says that violence in Iraq is bound to ebb and flow, and that it is challenging to draw many conclusions from a small number of attacks. Reporting for War News Radio, I'm Aaron Moser.
President Obama declared the end of combat missions in Iraq during an Oval Office address in August, saying that the U.S. had met its obligations in that country. But one American soldier remains missing in action, and his family is still waiting for answers. Jeremy Rappaport-Stein spoke with relatives in both countries in this piece, first aired in December.
For War News Radio, I'm Jeremy Rappaport-Stein. U.S. Army Sergeant Ahmed Altai had left the Green Zone to visit his new Iraqi wife in Baghdad when he was abducted. Several hours later, his ex-wife and close friend, Linda Racy, heard the news.
His mother had called me at about 11:30 at night on the night of October 23rd of 2006. I received a telephone call, and his mother was hysterical that her son was kidnapped.
Sergeant Altai, an Iraqi-American translator from Ann Arbor, Michigan, was abducted in Baghdad sometime after 4:30 p.m. on that Monday afternoon. 4 years later, he remains missing, and many questions, including what will happen in light of the end of combat missions in Iraq, remain unanswered. One of these questions is how Sergeant Altai was able to leave the Green Zone, the headquarters of U.S. military operations in Iraq.
And he went to go visit his wife, thinking he could blend in with the rest of the Iraqi population. And as soon as he arrived at her home, at a time that they had both agreed that he would be there, he didn't even pull up to her front on the street in the Karada district of Iraq, which is where she lives in Karada. And the kidnappers had thrown him into the back of a vehicle right at that moment.
According to an Associated Press report at the time, Four men, dressed all in black except for white masks covering their faces, dragged Altai from the home of his in-laws, handcuffed him, threw him in the back of their car, and drove off. The fact that this happened while Sergeant Altai was outside the Green Zone on personal business is a source of some surprise and confusion. According to Steve Valley, a former Green Zone public information officer and author of Inside the Fortress, A Soldier's Life in the Green Zone, the idea of a soldier getting out to visit his wife seems strange.
When I was there, there was virtually no way, unless you were decepting somebody, that you could get out of the Green Zone, nor any other military forward operating base.
But according to Valley, deceiving the extensive American security at the Green Zone is a nearly impossible task.
It would be extremely difficult. First of all, you have local Iraqis working the gates for civilians, and that's another checkpoint, another level of security where they ask for IDs, and then you also have the American military, who are the main keepers of the Green Zone, asking for IDs.
Valley said that when soldiers leave the Green Zone, they don't leave on foot.
I mean, you were going into the Red Zone, which was like the OK Corral. I mean, you were locked and loaded. You were driving in armored up vehicles. You had full battle rattle on. Your cargo pockets were filled with rounds of ammunition. And I mean, you know, the Red Zone was not a safe area, so it wasn't taken lightly to implement different levels of security. So this certainly was not something easy that this soldier supposedly had done. I mean, if he did it that way, it was well planned and well thought out.
If Sergeant Altai had been caught leaving the Green Zone without authorization, there would be disciplinary consequences.
That would probably be a non-judicial punishment, what you've commonly referred to as a Article 15.
Okay.
That's handled at the unit level between the immediate chain of command. I mean, and that's not a definitive answer. I mean, if he came out and said he snuck off base and was out visiting locals, the unit command, of course, could refer that to a JAG officer, and they could proceed with article with court-martial proceedings.
Despite the fact that his actions may have warranted disciplinary action were he not kidnapped, Ahmed Altai was promoted from a specialist to a sergeant in the wake of his abduction. The press releases at the time did not detail how it came to be that a soldier was outside the Green Zone on personal business. Another missing link in the story is who took Sergeant Altai to begin with. After he was abducted, the Army launched a massive search to find Sergeant Altai. The effort, however, was unsuccessful. At first, all signs pointed to the Mahdi Army, a radical Shiite militia created by cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The area in which Sergeant Altai was kidnapped is dominated by the militia group, and a video of Sergeant Altai was posted to a pro-Sadr website in 2007, intended to prove that he was still alive. Entifad Kanbar, Ahmed Altai's uncle and a prominent Iraqi politician, was involved in the effort to try and find him. Kanbar says that he's not convinced.
Well, the story is mixed up. I mean, you have to understand that Mahdi Army is not a disciplined, clear organization. Anybody, it's basically an army of volunteers, and that could be very fluid, and there is no clear structure for this army. The Mahdi Army themselves, people who I've known in the Mahdi Army, disowned them, and they said they have been not being part of the Mahdi Army. On the others say no, they were not Mahdi Army, but some other special Shia groups. That was the main issue for Ahmed. It was not very clear who has gotten him, and everybody says we know of him, but we are not the party or the entity which have him, and that has a lot to do with the chaotic nature of these militias.
Part of the problem of finding where Sergeant Altai is and figuring out who is responsible for his kidnapping is that the story of the abduction goes beyond the people who grabbed him off the streets.
I mean, the people who executed the process, the kidnapping, they have been arrested and they are in prison. I made an appeal to the court to lighten their sentence because the punishment for kidnapping in Iraq is execution. And I tried to convince the court to reduce their sentence to life in prison or something less than execution in return for their cooperation to find Ahmed. I think they did cooperate, but I think the fact that they have been in prison so long, they lost touch about his whereabouts.
Ahmed Altay has been gone for over 4 years now. From the looks of it, we still don't know precisely who was responsible for his abduction, where he is now, or how he managed to leave the heavily fortified Green Zone. What is certain is that his family and friends would like to see the story come to an end.
I myself wish to see Mr. Altay back alive to his family and to his mother and father, but I also would like to see a closure to this catastrophe and to this miserable days. And I will accept whatever God's will, even if he's dead, to bring a closure to his situation. But I also, naturally, I would not believe he's dead until I see 100% proof of his proof of his death, and if he's alive, that will be a serious miracle.
While reporting this story, War News Radio contacted multiple military and government sources, including the Army Office of Public Affairs, the U.S. Embassy in Iraq, and the Michigan National Guard. All requests for information were either declined, delayed, or referred to a non-responsive third party. According to the last press release concerning this case on the Department of Defense website, efforts continue to obtain the successful and safe return of Altay. That was December 14th, 2006. For War News Radio, I'm Jeremy Rappaport-Stein.
It's easy to talk about war in terms of numbers, casualties, years of conflict, or money spent, but art expresses what numbers cannot. In this piece, first aired in November, Amadi Lee speaks to artists and visitors at the Windows and Mirrors exhibit in Philadelphia.
Had you walked into the Art Street Meeting House in Philadelphia in October, you wouldn't have found just a Quaker religious center, but painting upon painting hanging from the walls. The traveling exhibit, called Windows and Mirrors, consists of 45 4x6-foot brightly colored mural panels. Most are painted with thick black lines outlining motifs of warfare, suffering, and violence. Three marionettes with pained expressions, the outline of a body on the ground missing a leg and an arm, an Afghan girl caught in the crosshairs of a rifle. A few have softer themes, of a kite flying above the Afghan countryside, or a butterfly emerging from the word salam, meaning peace in Arabic. Then there are drawings created and captioned by high school students in Kabul, showing what life is like for them during wartime. One shows a pigeon shot by crossfire. Another is of a young amputee with the text, "A boy's body is information about the war." Charles Kelly, a real estate salesman who came to see the exhibit, found the children's pictures among the most poignant.
I see the children calling out, "Help, help," in their, actually the little words attached to some of their drawings. And my feeling is, in front of this one, that I get some of the agony of a person hit by one of the United States bombs. And it's so easy to forget that people are dying agonizing deaths with our tax money. Like, you know, it makes me partially responsible, I think.
The war in Afghanistan entered its 10th year in October, but was hardly mentioned in the recent U.S. midterm elections. The American Friends Service Committee, or AFSC, conceived of Windows and Mirrors to bring awareness to, and, if possible, urge for the end of the war. The exhibit travels around the country, spending a month in each location. Karen Light, artist, teacher, and AFSC staff member, describes how the concept came about.
This came from the Chicago office, where we were talking about how to create something, and we wanted it to be artwork because we feel like it has a capacity to really touch people emotionally. And we wanted to come up with something that it wasn't so overwhelming that people felt like they couldn't act, like they got gripped by that, but also touching enough that people felt compelled to do something.
AFSC sent out a call to artists, and their prompt was simple: respond to civilian casualties in Afghanistan. The entries they received were numerous and varied.
We feel like we've gotten the range of emotion that anybody feels about war as a result. We've got suffering, we've got the pain, we've got the terror, you know, but we've also got the courage, we've got the information, we've got hope.
The artists themselves had a variety of motivations for participating in the show. Contributor Ann Northrup was motivated by the art form itself.
I've been working on these murals for 10 years, and the whole idea of a mural is, you know, a big public artwork has so much power beyond what I can wield in my little studio, you know, and my own little mind. And I just love the idea of a real public message that needs to be told. And so this project, with its theme of ending the war in Afghanistan, and with the backing of the American Friends Service Committee National Organization, has the power to really magnify my message.
Artist Deborah Gross-Zuckerman had a personal connection.
I was excited by this proposal because several years ago, our son Alex joined the Marines, and I had been doing many pieces against the war since then. It was hard for Philip and I to understand how our son, who had been taken to peace marches all his life, and son of two artists, could ever join the Marines. But it was something that he had to do, and as a result, it was something that I had to do by being creative in my artwork to express my feelings.
Joe Bredman, another contributor, was inspired by his desire to connect to the war.
That's something that is missing, you know, from many of our experiences. Very few Americans, I think, really know and have any real connection to that war. And yet, we're paying for it. And it's us that are supporting it.
Ultimately, the American Friends Service Committee is a pacifist Quaker organization, as Karen Light explains.
We also hope that people will just be compelled to pay more attention, to call their senators, to call their congresspeople, to bring up what they've learned to their family and friends. It could be as simple as that. But as somebody earlier mentioned, you know, it was really sad that in this election season, the war was hardly mentioned. And so we need it to be there. We need it to be something that people are talking about.
For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Kate Aronoff, Eliana Biscard-Church, Emily Bryant, Lewis Katz, Rosanna Kim, Amandine Lee, Via Latuvnenkus, John McMinn, Jared Nolan, and Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Anjali Kadambi.
And I'm Sam Hirschman. Until next time, thanks for listening.